You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
All right. Happy Sunday. Welcome back, everyone. We are live on X, YouTube, and Rumble. If you're watching the replay, it is going to be uploaded on Spotify afterwards for all of you that love podcasts. If you like what we're doing and want to help us keep going, please visit ddgeopolitics.com and get some merch. There are no tariffs. Shipping is free. There are no taxes. You can subscribe to us on Ko-fi, Substack, or any of our platforms. But we have a really big show today. There's been a lot. All the weeks seem shorter and the content just gets larger. Murat, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Yeah. It just seems like the prep time gets longer and longer each week. As I'm doing
it. I started prepping yesterday and I immediately wanted to kick my own ass because I was like, why didn't I do this all week long? Now I have no idea what happened in what order. And it took about 5 hours to get the episode even like prepped. But thanks to you and Aria, I think we'll get through it.
Sorry, I was saying that the updates come in like that change the news like before you even go live. And so you're like, do we talk about this right now or do we not?
I know. I was like, I better wait until about 8:30 to like close up this episode last night. And then this morning it's like update. Oh dear. But let's get into it. We have the world's biggest, most awesomest mineral deal written by none other than.
You just signed a minerals deal with Ukraine. It's a sign, it seems, that the United States is invested in Ukraine's future. The Secretary of State told me this is a very critical week. Are you any closer to reaching a peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia?
I hope so.
How would you characterize it?
I do believe we're closer with one party and maybe not as close with the other, but we'll have to see. I'd like to not say which one we're closer to, but we did do a deal for the American people that was good. We were able to get rare earth. You know, the Europeans are getting paid back. They have a loan. We didn't. Biden just gave him $350 billion. He has no idea where the money is, what happened. And at least we'll, in one form or another, get our, I don't feel so foolish. And remember this, this is Biden's war. This was a war that was never going to happen if I were president. This is a horrible, horrible war. And I get to see shots of soldiers through, you know, satellite that are so, just so terrible. 5,000 soldiers are being, look, 5,000 soldiers a week on average are dying. They're not American soldiers. But I want to solve the problem. They're Russian soldiers and they're Ukrainian soldiers. And if I can save 5,000 souls, I just love doing it.
How long do you give both countries before you're going to walk away?
Well, there'll be a time when I will say, okay, keep going, keep being stupid.
When does that fighting. Come? Are you close to it?
Sometimes I get close to it and then positive things happen. Okay.
What's the red line for you? At what point do you say that's it, we're walking away?
Well, you know, I mean, there'll be a time when I may say that, and if
but you're
I
not
do
there.
There may be something I can't maybe it's not possible to do. There's tremendous hatred, just so you understand. Krista, we're talking tremendous hatred between these two men and between, you know, some of the soldiers, frankly, between the generals. They've been fighting hard for 3 years. I think we have a very good chance of doing it.
I don't know that he answered any of our questions about the mineral deal, but he doesn't miss a chance to blame Biden and say that the war would have never happened had he been president back then. But we're going to go through a lot that shows that the war probably still would have happened. And Trump has no interest in stopping the war. Murat, what do you think about that? That video is from today, I believe, actually.
Well, I was going to say, Minerals reminds me of my favorite line in the Guy Ritchie film Snatch. You know, the British and Cockney. And when he's pointing the gun, he's like, "Oh, you think I ain't got the minerals?" anyway, so it's hard to say whether this deal is, I don't know what to make of this deal, because I don't know if this is good for the U.S., you know, because some analysts are seeing this as a way for the U.S. to prolong the war. You know, certainly this, you know, the U.S. interests are economic, but in the case of the war, they're seeing this as a way to further entrench themselves, because, you know, Trump is realizing that Putin may not be as, you know, amenable to listening to him as he thought. So, you know, in some ways, you know, this can be seen as somewhat of a desperate move by the U.S., who cannot broker a deal, you know, just on the strength of Trump, as they were hoping. In some ways, this is, this may be, you know, serving Russia in some ways, where there's no security guarantees for Ukraine. So, you know, the U.S. gets their cut, but Russia's main bottom line, which is, you know, avoiding these security guarantees for Ukraine, may, you know, it's still up in the air, because that part was not addressed. And that's like the most important part.
Well, let's go. I mean, everybody's kind of in the dark on this deal, but we can go through like some of the details that we do have. So there will be both Ukraine and the United States announced the creation of a U.S.-Ukraine Investment Fund, which is a joint investment vehicle that will be established between the two parties. The U.S. is to be represented by the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, and the Ukraine will be represented by its state agency for public-private partnership. So that's the keyword. That's what this is. And we're going to get a little bit more into that. So the fund is obviously going to focus on Ukraine's much-needed reconstruction or construction, because Ukraine hasn't really built a thing since its existence, 1991. So obviously the priorities are going to be focused on the rare earth and natural resource extraction. So the fund is going to be basically like a child savings account, so you, or an IRA or a 401k from your employer. So Ukraine will deposit 50% of all revenues from future state-owned sales of state-owned natural resource developments. And then the U.S. will contribute a match. So the U.S. is going to match their petulant child's allowance, so they could buy something later on. So they're all tax exempted. Ukraine is now forced to guarantee that the U.S. will not be charged for exchange rates, and there's unrestricted capital transfers abroad. The fund gives priority rights to all U.S. firms, so they get preferential treatment and investments and purchasing before any EU. This agreement will supersede anything that Ukrainian law passes, and there is no like provisions for the EU, and then no expiration date. Really incredible. The fact that it has no expiration date is pretty amazing. And then both parties need to agree in order to terminate it. So a very weird deal. Like you mentioned, there's no security and guarantees in it for Ukraine, which is something that they were really banking on and they're not going to get. You know, they were refused to join NATO. They were denied for now anyway. And that was going to give them the security guarantees that they so much sought after with Article 5. Now they get no security guarantees with their mineral deal. And also wanted to touch on, you know, some of the resources, whether these maps are up to date as of this past week. Maybe they're a little bit off, who knows, but let's take a look at where some of the resources are. So this is where the resources are. We do know that there's a lot of fighting going along that Donbas front. That blue streak of, I guess that's iron, would be contested, and everything obviously under Russian feet is not going to be pillaged by the United States. Here's the worth, though. I think this is much more important. Everything's under Russian feet. There's nothing really worth anything outside of the Donbas. pretty incredible. Do you think that Trump knows that there's not a lot left after that? Or is what do you think that kind of Trump's motivation is behind this? It limits Ukraine's autonomy in its own in managing its own resources. This is something we've seen in the past. We'll get into a little bit more of comparison. But what do you think kind of off the bat? This seems kind of like a bum deal for Ukraine.
Well, it was always going to be a bum deal for Ukraine. It also just kind of seems like a bum deal for the U.S. And this was what I was saying was that there's one way to read this deal as, you know, just something that helps, not help, but like something that favors Russia because they, you know, the part of this deal that, you know, would most favor the other side, they can't even access it. And so that's what I was getting at is that like this, there's a lot of question marks in this deal. There's a lot of nebulous aspects to it, but Ukraine functionally becomes a protectorate of the U.S. You know, that's kind of the best way to read it is that the this is a new form of imperialism, right? Where we kind of have them enter into this vassalage where, you know, there are new question marks about sovereignty and where we stand with that now. But yes, I mean, as you said, we have this bizarre superseding superseding nature to this law because, or to this deal, because it over, you know, it comes over any kind of Ukrainian law and it is indefinite, as you said, right?
It's definitely
there's no time. So it's in a sense, it's like a super bill. And so, yeah, I mean, what is Ukrainian sovereignty at this point?
whatever, what was it ever, honestly?
Yeah, and Ukraine, it's, you know, this is the new, like, this is the new front in this war is these countries in the middle that become, you know, their sovereignty comes into question becomes because they are on the battle lines. And, you know, Armenia is, you know, another example of this.
We're going to get into that, too. Some analysts have already made the comparisons to the Development Fund for Iraq, which is known as the DFI. It was established in 2003 under the UN Security Council. And obviously, it was established during the U.S.-led invasion. Approximately $150 billion flowed through this fund, with later audits revealing that about 74% of all large contracts were awarded to U.S. firms without any competitive bidding, with Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root receiving the lion's share. There were they noted no oversight and severely lacking oversight. Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction reported over $8.7 billion unaccounted for due to weakness in financial controls. So, I mean, it was really just a money grab in Iraq. You brought up Armenia. What did you have to say about that?
Well, with Armenia, the similarity I saw is the lack of security guarantees. I mean, here we have, you know, resources and, you know, and money being traded for no security guarantee. And with Armenia, there's, you know, for now, there's just been, you know, kind of promises and sort of encouraging words from the West. And so that they've encouraged this pivot in the wake of the security disaster that happened in Artsakh. And once again, there are no security guarantees. There's no deal in the case of Armenia, but it finds itself in a similar precarious position where it's kind of hanging in the middle and it's, you know, in neither camp. Because the understanding of this deal is that, you know, it remains to be seen how entrenched we become. But for now, it looks like, you know, that this is just a bad deal, you know, for Ukraine, especially because they'll just get hollowed out. But from a military standpoint, where is Ukraine? We don't know.
I mean, you drew a comparison to Armenia in this case of the security guarantees. I brought up the Iraq thing in the case of resource and contract mismanagement. And we could take a look at both of those places. And if that's what's in store for the future of our Ukraine, that's quite uncertain. Iraq was lucky enough that China got involved in a major way with a ton of investments in infrastructure repairs, whether you agree or like that China's there or not, but they did come in. Armenia is finding itself in sort of this limbo where they're like, well, do we go east? Do we go west? What do we do? We have no security guarantees. We have no CISTO. We have no NATO. And then Ukraine is in that same exact position. And Ukraine is not a member of CSTO as Armenia once was. Yeah. So this leaves Ukraine very much in the lurch. Are they just too stupid to realize it, or do they just not care?
Well, they certainly cared, but they, you know, were kind of just, I don't know if they long-term planned, but, you know, they have been led to a bad point. There are questions about the legitimacy of this deal due to the legitimacy of Zelensky. I mean, you know, we forget that he, his term expired, and the fact that he's still president is kind of more of a, you know, an exception in this case. And so there are questions of, is this a valid deal if, you know, the head of state that's in power is still kind of just on a technicality still there. I don't know, but this does also follow a broader pattern that the U.S. does where, you know, there's a war, and then after the war, you know, in the wreckage, you make a deal to, you know, invest and be a part of rebuilding it. And so, you know, that's a boon for the U.S. in some ways, but it does hollow out the country that it happens in.
Yeah, it's just more disaster capitalism, a lot of that sort of shock doctrine without the initial shock and all. If you guys haven't read Naomi Klein, it's probably our best book now that she's kind of liberal. But it was probably her best book, The Shock Doctrine, which will tell you all about disaster capitalism and how private firms do go into these countries that are war-torn or poor and kind of hollow them out, just like they did to Iraq. And 8 billion is a very conservative number. There were hundreds of billions of dollars that went through Iraq and were gone. But then we move on because, you know, Trump was going to end this war. And we thought he's trying to pass off this mineral deal as sort of, you know, this is sort of, you know, the sun, we're sunsetting. We're getting ready to take this to a close. We're going to start establishing things. So you thought what happened this week? Oh, I don't know. Trump gives another another arms deal to Ukraine. What makes this one different? Everybody said, oh, it's only $50 million. It's just $50 million. Okay, yeah, we get it. But what separates this is that the $50 is a minimum. That's the threshold. So what this actual deal does is that it basically, Ukraine hands over its economic sovereignty, all of the natural resources and whatnot, and that will be in exchange for U.S. weapons. There's no binding security guarantee, and Ukraine pays with minerals or through EU financial channels. So Ukraine isn't being prepped for peace. It's being locked into the long-term kind of cycle of natural resources for arms. So $50 million, like I said, it's a threshold, and that unlocks the export license that then private contractors can come in and utilize. It's the first military transaction that has occurred after the minerals deal. So I wanted to point this out because pairing private defense exports with the resource fund is very interesting. This sort of interlacing of economic dependency and arms dependency, it just really solidifies the vassalage of Ukraine or future vassalage of Ukraine. And I also wanted to bring this up because recently, and you guys are going to bear with me. I know I do this every stream, but I'm going to do it. Okay. Anduril recently locked in a contract with the UK. They struck a deal with the UK United Kingdom government to provide drone systems to Ukraine. Anduril and Palantir Technologies were both engaged heavily in the genocide in Gaza. They supplied the IDF with AI technologies, and in return, the IDF helped to train their AI by killing various Palestinians and using facial recognition technology. Next, don't forget that Anduril, Palantir, and SpaceX have all partnered to build the Golden Dome, which is the subscription-based and air defense system. The plan is to launch 1,000 satellites to monitor global missile strikes, and then a separate contractor will launch another 200 attack satellites. So Trump has obviously ordered the first one of these, and then after that, they will be on a subscription-based plan for whomever or whatever warlord would like to utilize these. And then finally, I do want to make a note that a few months ago, Palantir and Anduril were in talks together with SpaceX and OpenAI to form a consortium to jointly bid for U.S. Defense contracts. So that's what this is. That's what the $50 million is. That's what the mineral deal is. It's the more of the privatization and the guarantees of giving their friends preferential treatment to the spoils. And maybe am I off the mark? Am I like going down a rabbit hole?
I don't think you are, because one thing I forgot to mention, and this kind of foreshadows as someone else will talk about today, who is the architect of this deal, the mineral deal? Stephen Miller, the newly announced, I think he's not really announced yet, but he's the top front runner for the NSA chief. But he wasn't, he was very intimately involved in the process.
I didn't know that. Okay, that changes everything now, because in the Stephen Miller segment, no spoilers, but we will get to it. Oh my God. That's incredible.
This represents this kind of change of the NSA, which is supposed to be a foreign policy foreign agency. It's turning it into one that, will spy on domestic citizens in the same way that we spy elsewhere.
Oh my God.
We're turning
Whitney Webb and Ryan Dawson. Sorry, you have to be Ryan in this equation, but that's who we're going to get compared to. Don't forget also, speaking of crazy influencers, we have an update, not Whitney Webb. Whitney Webb's fantastic. We have an update on the Ukrainian 124 transporter. That story, see, you guys, the people criticize me for following whomever, but I got this story from Laura Loomer. So F-16's being loaded onto a 124. What's fantastic about Laura, she's like, a subscriber sent this into me. I don't really know what it is, but it looks crazy. So we just dug into it. And I was like, clear to Laura Loomer to give me a tip. But we confirmed that the aircraft was loading decommissioned F-16 airframes from the Davis. It's a joint Air Force base boneyard. And obviously they're stripped of all of their electronic and sort of avionics equipment and anything that's classified on board. But this coincides with the U.S. State Department's recent approval of a $310 million foreign military sale to Ukraine. So this package includes the training, the support, the maintenance, the spare parts, and the technical documentation for the F-16. So very interesting. This is also covered under that $50 million threshold as well. So the war in Ukraine is not coming to a close. I think that the one side that Trump's talking about that doesn't want peace is probably the technocrats inside of America. We were talking about this prior. I would say, I don't remember who it was we were talking about. I think it might have been Charles Johnson and maybe Richard Spitzer. But we were talking about the forever war lobby. And it's all the people that are in these sort of techno bros, defense contractors, and not the ones that you think of. It's not like, oh, the stereotypical Lockheed Martin. Sure, they would like for it to continue, but it's really the techno bros with all this AI sort of technology and satellite technology. Really crazy stuff.
Boy, all right. And the neocon establishment there's a Twitter user who has a talking point he often makes, which he calls, it's all one thing, which is like, pharma, business, finance, military. All these interests, this is the deep state, is these various, wealthy interests that have an interest in all this, in the war continuing outside of, U.S. sovereign interests.
It's interesting because do you feel like and I don't want to get off too far, but do you feel like the deep state has sort of changed? Like, this isn't the deep state that I thought it was. Like, this deep state is not quite, it's still nefarious, but it's not like as, hellish and demonic as people made it sound.
I think we're in a transition period for the deep state. I think it's largely the same. It's just that generation's aging out. So there are new people coming in, and there is this tech bro aspect to it that wasn't there before. But I think it's largely the same. I think it still is just, military defense and financial interests, and kind of they've evolved in some of the ways that the companies are involved in, or the way that they lobby government. But I think it's still largely the same.
You think that the tech bros were just like, well, the most lucrative thing is just war, so they kind of went from like social media media and AI to like, well, this is the natural progression. So now they've kind of just become the deep state because.
Yes. And it was inevitable because of the way that tech can assist government in monitoring people or, you know, aside from military tech, of course. But I think it's this transition into technology that, you know, can keep tabs on people and, you know, in this like kind of Snowden modern era. I think that's been the key point where the tech pros have really become someone that the government's looking at and have been able to catch the government's ear in terms of what they can bring. And now, you know, they have the wealth as well to, you know, as we see with Elon Musk, to influence government.
It's just, it's crazy that we're not really like, and somebody mentioned BlackRock, of course, but we're not really dealing with just the, you know, these aren't your mama's military industrial complex firms. These are like BlackRock, OpenAI, which I use every day. Like, it's really crazy. But, and one more thing about Ukraine, not to leave Zelensky out. He's obviously having his own mental breakdown this week. As Putin stated that a ceasefire would be put in place. It's put in place regardless whether they agree to it or not. If they break it, obviously Russia will take retaliatory measures. But Putin wanted to put one in place from May 7th to May 10th, midnight to midnight, in honor of the 80th anniversary. Lavrov immediately came out after the announcements and said, this is a good step towards peace talks without preconditions. You know, if we can get a ceasefire through that just says, just stop everything, then this is a really good platform. I know that Lavrov knew that this was definitely coming from the Foreign Ministry of Ukraine. We don't want these peace talks. We're only going to take 30 days. So it's a propaganda ceasefire for the May 9th parade. Can't get a ceasefire for the 80th anniversary of the victory over fascism. Funnily enough, on Friday, State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce announced that the U.S. will no longer act as mediator between Russia and Ukraine. So this also coincides with everything that we've been talking to leading up to this. I just thought this was really interesting that they're really washing their hands.
Is he considering secondary sanctions on Russia?
Well, we know, again, that he's stated his willingness to do that, about the nature of, clearly we're not removing any sanctions that currently exist. The president wants, in every action that we've taken as a nation, to do it diplomatically. That he wants, clearly, because of the, you know, the commitment to it. And yet he knows also that there's another part of the world, a whole globe that needs some attention. And the secretary has also made it very clear that while our style will change, the methodology of how we contribute to this will change in that we will not be the mediators. That is what I mentioned on Tuesday, and the nature of how this would change is we certainly are still committed to it and we'll help and do what we can, but we are not going to fly around the world at the drop of a hat to mediate meetings that it is now between the two parties. And now is the time that they need to present and develop concrete ideas about how this conflict is going to end. It's going to be up to them.
We're taking our ball and we're taking our mineral deal and going home. We got what we needed. We don't need to do this anymore. I love how they made it sound like it was such a hassle too. We're flying in and out. We're flying at the drop of a hat. We're got drop of a dime to go do these peace talks. This is what you campaigned on.
Yeah. When I said that, like, we look, you know, it's kind of a loss for the U.S. as well, is that like, this just looks bad for Trump, because so much for the quick peace. There was a lot of hope that the war was going to stop in a quick amount of time once he was in office, because you know, there was this sort of, you know, confidence on his part and kind of belief that Putin may listen to him or you know may sit down with him, but they just look like a clown show mostly. But yeah, as you said, they're taking their ball and going home, the U.S. looks irrelevant, really. They don't really sound in tune with what's going on. Sounds like they're just kind of patting themselves on the back every time they go out there. But everything that's actually happening in practice is just kind of just going over their heads.
It's just like the U.S. doesn't do diplomacy anymore. Like, was Kissinger our last diplomat, maybe? Like, I don't, the U.S. does not do diplomacy. like at all. They don't even know how.
Yeah, I mean, well, it wasn't John Kerry. I don't know if we got to go back to the computer, but
it's John McCain, John Kerry, Victoria Nuland. That was our last diplomat.
Yeah, but I mean, the coming multipolar world, you know, if you will, you know, is the harbinger of this receding U.S. diplomacy, right? And so, if this is what it looks like, then you know, so be it. But that's what it looks like to me.
So then we get through that. They're not involved anymore as Zelensky's threatening to start World War III in the Red Square. Saturday, Zelensky fully rejected the May 9th ceasefire, saying they will follow the U.S. model of an unconditional ceasefire for a minimum of 30 days. But the U.S. just said that they're no longer involved. So maybe it's an old model that Zelensky still has on his desk. Then he threatened a few dozen world leaders, saying, "We cannot be responsible for what is happening on the territory of the Russian Federation. They provide you with safety, and so we will not give you any guarantees." Pretty bold statement from Zelensky. That's the puppy. Obviously, world leaders did react. Dmitry Medvedev said, I'll just read it. We'll probably get demonetized for it, but the unshaven green douchebag says he rejects Putin's proposal of a 3-day ceasefire to commemorate May 9th and cannot guarantee the safety of world leaders in Moscow. Who was asking him for guarantees? This is nothing more than a verbal provocation. The louse knows that if there's a real provocation on Victory Day, no one will be able to guarantee that Kiev will live to see May 10th. And the Kremlin followed that by saying that they're still waiting for an official response from Zelensky.
I saw that in the notes. I wasn't sure if you had maybe, I can't believe that was his actual statement. Did he have Grok write that? Or that sounds like an AI, like the mouse knows that.
Here's the thing. I mean, it's probably the translation, you know, probably a little bit of the translation. It was on his Twitter, but Medvedev spoke before this, before AI translation and AI generated speech. So he's always talked like this. So I'm quick to believe that this is him. But you know, and obviously other world leaders responded to this. Namely Robert Fico, who's one of my personal favorites, who fell ill this week, had to cancel a few meetings, but now has come back and said he will definitely be attending the May 9th celebration, and he had this to say.
Dámy a páni, musím zareagovať na vonkajšie faktory. Poprvé, musím sa ohradiť voči vyjadreniam ukrajinského prezidenta Zelenského, ktorý ako keby sa vyhrážal, že čo sa všetko môže stať počas osláv víťazstva nad fašizmom 9. mája v Ruskej federácii. To je nevídané. To je pre mňa jednoducho až smiešné. To, akože nám odkazuje pán Zelenský, ja som malý hráč, o mňa nejde, ale odkazuje čínskemu prezidentovi, odkazuje brazilskému prezidentovi, odkazuje prezidentom a hlavám štátov a premiérom z krajín, kde žijú 100 milióny obyvateľov, že nechoďte tam, pozor. Lebo my, Ukrajina, vám niečo urobíme. To sa nerobí. Ja odmietam takéto vyhrážanie sa kvôli bezpečnosti. Plne rešpektujem, že bezpečnosť zúčastnených je internou záležitosťou Ruskej federácie. Ale rovnako, ak sa domnieva pán Zelenský, že tieto jeho výkriky spôsobia, že tam zahraničné delegácie neprídu, tak je na obrovskom omyle. Ale musel som sa ohradiť k takémuto spôsobu vyjadrovania. Je mi veľmi ľúto, že pán Zelenský a ďalší miešajú minulosť s prítomnosťou. Pre Boha, veď to boli aj ukrajinskí vojaci, ktorí zomierali v rokoch 1941 a 1945 a zomierali masovo v druhej svetovej vojne. Naopak teraz bolo treba prijať návrh na prímerie, pokiaľ išlo oslavy 80. výročia. A minimálne, keď už nezablahožela cíku k ukončeniu druhej svetovej vojny, tak byť ticho. Je to veľká neúcta, ak niekto krajine, ktorá mala najväčší podiel na víťazstve nad fašizmom a mala absolútne najväčšie obete, aké si vieme predstaviť, odkazuje, No oslavujte si, my vám tam možno hodíme nejaký droník alebo niečo podobné. To sú neakceptovateľné veci pre mňa. Toto do modernej politiky nepatrí.
Really interesting, good, great statement coming from the leader of a country who fell to fascism during World War II and is now going, for those of our listeners that may not know, Joseph Tiso? Is that, am I right? Joseph Tiso, leader of clerical fascist Slovakia when it broke away from Czech Republic during World War II. Really interesting that he's quick to go to May 9th and Zelensky actually threatens to bomb it. I'm glad that he cited history. This is also a leader who was almost assassinated by a Ukrainian like zealot. So really, really interesting. Do you have any thoughts on that before we close out on Ukraine, or any thoughts on Ukraine and Russia in general?
Well, also to add that Slovakia, when it was part of Czechoslovakia, you know, while it happened in Prague and not necessarily in Bratislava, they have their own difficult history with Moscow. And so that was a very strong statement, kind of just, you know, if not pro-Russia, but just kind of pro-tradition and honoring, you know, the sacrifice for World War II. So I do agree that was a very strong statement.
Yeah, he always comes out with great, great stuff. He's like a better version of Orban, I think. And this like trifecta of Orban, Vucic, and Fico, I'm kind of digging. They're also forming an alliance. We won't get into it, but they're forming an alliance in the Balkans. Just so you know, all world wars start in the Balkans. Anyway, moving on. This is Trump's first 100 days. We spent 45 minutes on just Trump's debacle in Ukraine. I'm not going to get into a recap of his first 100 days, but I will start off with what he thinks about it.
What do you say to those who believe you are taking the country down an authoritarian path?
Well, there you go again. Why don't you ask it a different way? Many people wanted to come into our country. Many people love Trump. I won the election. They didn't win the election. I got a lot more votes than they did. I won the popular vote. I won all seven swing states by a lot. A lot of people were surprised. They said, I think you could win four, maybe five. No, I won all seven. And I won by a lot, and I won actually. I think there was a lot of hanky-panky going on, but it was too big to rig. That's the good news. It's too big to rig. But let me just say, so when you make these statements about people say this, people, well, you know, they had their chance at the election, and they lost big. So you should ask the question differently. You should say, what about the people that want to be in this country? What about the people that love this country?
But what do you say? I'm asking it on behalf of those people. To give you a chance to respond to them. What do you say to those people, sir?
Those people are going to be very happy. They're going to have to see some results. And I think we had a great 100 days. There are a lot of people that say it was unprecedented. It was an absolutely unprecedented 100 days. And I hope that they're going to be right.
And I hope that they're going to be right. Well, it's already over. So are they right or not? There's a lot of hanky-panky. Did he ever
was there ever going to be a chance that he gave himself anything other than like an A+? I mean, was he ever going to be like, you know, we could have done this? No, of course not. He was going to be like, this was the greatest. You know, people are saying this was the greatest 100 days they've ever seen in their life. In fact, they're saying it was the greatest 100 days they've enjoyed in their life. This is just like typical Trump, self-patting on the back. Hanky panky was funny though.
I really love it. Too big to rig. It was too big to rig. When we win, it's too big to rig. When we lose, it's rigged.
I said I was going to get four, five. I got all seven.
All seven. Hanky panky. Don Zuger. Trump is the kingdom, the power, and the glory now and forever. Amen. I mean, Trump came out with his, I don't have it uploaded. I wish I did. Trump did come out with his AI generated version of him as the Pope. So who knows? We could be seeing Trump as the kingdom, the power, and the glory, I guess. Anyway, I've enjoyed the first 100 days, whether you guys have or not. I'm not really sure, but I'm sure enjoyed it. Anyway, Waltz is out. So that's where the conclusion of this 100 days. Waltz is out. So just to recap, there's a plethora of reasons why, but mostly because of the Signalgate scandal. which everybody knows, March 2025, Waltz took the blame for adding Jeffrey Goldberg to the Atlantic editor to a Signal group chat where they discussed the strikes on Yemen. He's also recently been accused of unauthorized communications with Israel, which how are any communications with Israel unauthorized at this point? I mean, they're literally just, I don't even know where our government ends and the Israeli one begins. And not that Israel's controlling us, and not at all, but they're just so integrated, so well integrated that it's like, how are these communications sort of sus? But Waltz reportedly engaged in unapproved discussions with Bibi regarding potential military actions against Iran, which contradicted President Trump's preference for diplomatic solutions over military interventions. I'm not buying it. I'm not buying that's why he got the axe.
Well, I kind of liken it to The Bachelor, you know, when this is the conclusion of season one, you know,
the roses? The
first 100 days. And it's like, we knew someone was going to leave because
someone's going to get voted
off. There's no Trump cabinet that just stays put. So like, we knew someone was going to have to, you know, get voted off. And Waltz had the biggest scandal, which was Signalgate. Why do you not buy it? What do you think was the reason?
I just think somebody has to take the fall. He's expendable. And we're going to get to why I think that he's getting out. And we're going to talk about that more in depth. But first, according to Drop Site News, this is the thing. If he's getting canned over unwarranted or not allowed discussions with Bibi, on the day he's leaving, he's uploading his Signal chats to an Israeli archiving app called Telemessage. So Telemessage TM Signal that will back up your Signal chat. So this app is tied to Israeli intelligence circles and is designed to copy and store encrypted chats. It's like, if that's why he got the can, why is he over here uploading his chats to an Israeli archive? Just madness. It was Drop Site News with that story, so all credit goes to them.
Israeli archiving app. I mean, does it get anywhere? I mean, he might as well have been uploading to like Zio Drive or something. Like couldn't it just be any better? I mean, Signalgate. I mean, what can you say? I also just love this new way that we like figure things out, which is have a journalist zoom in on a person's phone from far away and then just take a quick snapshot of what they're doing. I mean, apparently we can get state secrets like that now.
And now we get to the good part. I'm even looking forward to this. So he's out, who's in? So for now, Rubio is going to occupy both Secretary of State and head of NSA. Our NSA, which is reminiscent of Kissinger, but he's not going to hold it for too long, obviously. They said he's very, very busy at working at the State Department. So he can't fill both roles. So who is the front runner? He's one of my favorites just because of the character, not because I'll show you the puppy here. The puppy's going crazy, very, very naughty today. But anyway, so Stephen Miller is one of my favorites. I find him so fascinating. So I'm really glad that we're going to talk about him a little bit at length. So his wife is currently employed at DOGE, which is, I kind of wanted to make an interesting note of. He's currently serving as a Homeland Security advisor. So this would be an enormous jump. And he's going to go from obviously shaping domestic policy surrounding immigration and whatnot. And now he'll be jumping to one of the most powerful positions in the world, actually. White House sources have stated that he has made the Homeland Security Council run like clockwork and that it's infinitely more effective than the NSC with a tiny fraction of the staff, noting that Rubio and Miller have worked together in the past and they worked well together and they have established rapport. So this is really interesting. And I'm glad that we brought it up because Stephen Miller is aligned with Palantir. So what did you want us to elaborate on?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the NSA, you know, it's a foreign intelligence agency, but this sort of represents a way that Stephen Miller, commonly an immigration guy and someone who is working on immigration, and putting him in the NSA is a signal that we're going to be treating open borders as a state security issue. Yeah, I mean, this is it. I mean, Stephen Miller, what a rise. He's, you know, a favorite of the kind of the nationalist wing of MAGA. Very few people in Trump's circle have consistently, you know, maintained a, you know, quote unquote, approval rating, if you will, but just like a high approval rating among like the true diehard MAGA supporters, as much as Stephen Miller. I feel like that guy, you know, he draws the ire of liberals, and the MAGA side loves it. And, you know, he had a really memorable press conference this week. He goes out there. I mean, this guy really is just like a character. He's just straight out of casting, and he kind of really plays up that fascist, you know, American sort of character well. But yeah, I mean, the big story here is that like our borders and this immigration issue is now like a state security issue.
I love him because he's I don't know that he's really evil or that he's just like playing it up, but he's like just really leans into the whole. He's like Daniel Day-Lewis. He's like method acting. Like this whole persona is this. And what's with these like these kind of like very fascistic Jews? I find it very, very interesting that the Jews actually come out as like the most fascistic and authoritarian, not saying that in a negative way, just saying that in a very factual way. And speaking of Jews, Stephen Miller is very good friends with Jared Kushner. So there's that element. He also very much encouraged Trump to rip up the JCPOA during his first term. And he is backed. He's backing anti-BDS executive orders and crackdowns on pro-Palestinian activism. He's one of the spearheads. Him and Rubio are two people that really spearheaded the campaign against college campuses. He also, here's the next one. Every week, guys, we do it. He also much favors the use of proxy forces and PMCs, mercenaries, over the use of American troops because he's friends with Eric Prince. So it's like, it never ends. And he's very ideologically aligned with someone from our next video. But I want to, and you said this earlier, is that kind of like they thought they were going to instill this new guard. And it's really like, no, we're still in charge. Like we're going right back to like, not totally neocon, but pretty, pretty close.
Every time you think you're going to change the system, it's the system that changes you. So it is still the old guard. New pieces are interchangeably replaced. And so over time, there's like a slow evolution, but it always still is the old beast.
It's just
I think you're right. I mean, between the relations to the Iran deal and to Palantir, this is all one thing, right? It's all connected.
And just to show you, John Bolton had something to say about it, too.
I think Witkoff reports directly to Trump. That's the advantage he has. He will do exactly what Trump says. And I think this is a disaster in the making, a disaster on the Ukraine-Russia front, a potential disaster on the Iran front. I mean, if you look at Witkoff, he doesn't know anything about Ukraine. He doesn't know anything about Russia. He doesn't know anything about Iran. He doesn't know anything about nuclear weapons. He doesn't know anything about arms control and nonproliferation. And he doesn't know anything about state-to-state negotiation. Really, it's hard to imagine a less qualified person. And yet he is Trump's personal envoy.
Really interesting. So we have Waltz out. Witkoff is John Bolton calls an idiot. I agree. I really don't like John Bolton. But he says Witkoff is an idiot and vastly unqualified. But maybe has a point there because the Iran talks fell apart this week. So that's also in there. You know, on Friday, the Wall Street Journal confirmed that the U.S.-Iran nuclear talks were suspended. No date set. We're getting conflicting messages. So Iranian officials said, you know, the U.S. hasn't really made this any easier. They've been sanctioning us this whole time. Depending on the U.S.'s approach, the next round of talks will be announced. But the U.S. said we never said we were even coming to a fourth round of talks. All of this coinciding with recently Trump stating, I won't be dragged into a war. I'll be leading the charge. And now the Iran nuclear talks fall apart. And we have explosions, another explosion in Iran today, another huge fire. So, I mean,
I'm the next couple of weeks, you know, there, if a deal will happen, it'll be quick. And, you know, if it doesn't, then that is a bad omen for war. I had thought that, you know, I did think that Trump would want to get a deal done because he really wanted the good press here. But it looks like this thing is kind of falling apart. And so this is a bad sign for, you know, people concerned about war with Iran.
I agree. I think that, you know, Bolton, obviously, he always says, he never met a war he didn't love. He never met a coup he didn't love. He wanted to go after Iran. Rubio has wanted to go after Iran. Stephen Miller is a hardliner for Iran. It doesn't bode well, especially with the deadline. I believe it was set, forgive me, I keep on citing this date, correct me if I'm wrong, May 25th was the absolute deadline for these talks before they were supposed to go forward with some sort of other whether diplomatic or military action.
So. Yeah, there was about 4 weeks left. You know, last time when we spoke, and yeah, I mean the short amount of time that's left here, it's, you know, it doesn't give a whole lot of confidence. But so much for the no new wars president. I mean, it's looking like, you know, MAGA often likes to kind of throw around how no new wars were started under Trump, and, you know, it's Democrats that start wars, and you know, we want to end them. But the this is not looking like the no new wars administration.
This is getting psychotic, honestly. Like, this is getting really weird and psychotic. Mm-hmm. Speaking of psychotic, saw MTG's tweet today. Not to mention, she did a little bit of insider trading of her own with Palantir earlier this week. But not to, you know, little, she got to do her little controlled opposition bit. Here we go. Tomorrow, the House is voting on H.R. 867, which is the IGO Anti-Boycott Act sponsored by Representative Mike Lawler. This is for Americans participating in boycotts of Israel or its settlements if these boycotts are endorsed by international bodies like the UN or the EU. So in other words, any BDS whatever campaigns that are sponsored or sanctioned by the UN or the EU are illegal in the United States if this goes through tomorrow. So a little bit more, just the kind of, I don't want to get into too much like moral fagging, but like a little bit more of the new sort of tightening and this sort of clamping down on more speech. Very interesting, especially with the way that this, we're sort of entering in a very highly surveilled state.
Exactly. That was all I had on this book, that like, you know, we may see more legislation like this as, you know, the security state expands. But for H.R. 867, I'm seeing, you know, most analysis I saw is it doesn't look like there's a strong chance this passes unless there's some accompanying legislation with it.
Yeah, that's why I didn't want to dwell on it too. I just want to throw it out there that these are the things that these people actually think about and like want to pass. It's going onto the House floor tomorrow. So it's only out of committee. So we'll see tomorrow. But I didn't want to bring it up because I'd like to show people these sorts of signs. And I've told the listeners multiple times, there's a clip floating around of me saying it too. But as the powers or the ones that hold the levers of power start to feel like their grip is slipping off of those, they're going to enact things that they think will allow them to firm their grasp on that power, and they become more and more irrational as they lose more and more power. And that's why we're seeing these crazy irrational laws and well, we're going to do this. We're going to outlaw anti-Semitism. That's because they're losing a grip on control. That's all that this is. And that's why I kind of point these things out, because it's good news. It's bad news. We have to kind of endure it, but it's good news.
A lot of like obviously people, like the dumbos online will focus on it being a free speech thing. Yeah. They're like, oh, we can't, they don't let us say anything bad about Israel. And it's like, they focus on the wrong part when it's
exactly.
Like, the issue here is the boycott part that they don't like, as opposed to just someone saying something, which you can say, and, you know, everyone does say every day. The broader issue is the, you know, the boycott and divest and sanction part that seems to concern Israel, you know, in a great way.
Well, money. Never mind. You know, I'm not going to make the joke. Let's just leave it alone. All right. Speaking of Israel, they started bombing Damascus, which I knew you were going to hate this as soon as I brought it up, because what sparked the whole thing, and I don't mean to laugh, I shouldn't laugh because it's very serious, but it's ridiculous, what actually is the catalyst to all of this. So apparently there was some recording, a fabricated audio recording or taken out of context or something that was allegedly a Druze cleric insulting the Prophet Muhammad. So Syrian state security forces went down to the Druze communities and killed a bunch of people. So Israel retaliated to that. So there was sectarian clashes between Druze fighters and government-linked Sunni forces between April 9th and May 1st. So there were ongoing clashes for 3 days. This resulted in the deaths of at least 10 civilians, 61 Druze fighters, and at least 30 state forces. Israel then warned Syria not to harm the Druze, but then once the casualties mounted, they launched the airstrikes, which they said were targeting extremist factions that were threatening the Druze civilians. The airstrikes, I think they began on the 1st. Interestingly enough, the first set of airstrikes struck the vicinity of the presidential palace overnight. And they didn't hit the presidential palace, obviously, for obvious reasons. But Israel Katz said, "The Air Force attack last night on the presidential palace in Damascus, which the prime minister and I directed, is a clear warning message to the Syrian regime. When Jolani wakes up in the morning and sees the results of the Israeli Air Force attack, he understands very well that Israel is determined to prevent harm to the Druze in Syria." On May 2nd, Israel started striking HGS-backed groups, Turkish-funded SNA factions, and air defense batteries across Hama, Latakia, and Idlib. It hit Idlib very hard. Now, I think that that's not just the Damascus one, but the Idlib one is very important because that's the message that they're trying to send. Weren't we like on the cusp or kind of not on the cusp, but we were whispering about maybe normalizing or like kind of getting relations better between Syria and Israel? Do you think, forgive me, do you think that the fabricated recording could maybe be fabricated by Israel?
Well, definitely, of course. And the more important thing here is that like the Israel and Turkey are not normalizing, right? And it does seem like there is this growing tension. And, you know, when the divide and conquer strategy is always kind of the way that you chip away further and further, you know, as a great power. And so the Druze find themselves being the ones here that are kind of in the middle of this tug of war, right? Because Israel and Turkey each want to stake their position in Syria, and the Druze are going to be, you know, the ones that one of these bridge groups in between. And so this is unfortunate, you know, that what we're seeing now, and there's always, you know, talk about who the Druze would want to side with. But I do think that this represents a coming showdown between Israel and Turkey, and we'll see what happens with NATO or what that means for, you know, the U.S.'s decision. But I think that, you know, usually Turkey is portrayed as the expanding aggressor, and Israel is portrayed as, you know, always in the defensive. And here we know this is going to be where we really see it all exposed, because, you know, certainly Israel is not acting defensively here. They're trying to expand out as much as they can. And Turkey also has, you know, expansionist plans. For Erdogan, this Syria campaign is going to be, or not even for Erdogan, but for the neo-Ottomanist aspects or the factions in Turkey, the Syria campaign is the make or break, because if you screw up in Syria, you can't talk about expanding out, you know, bringing back the Ottoman world, because right. If you can't handle this one, then that's over with. So I think a lot rests on this for Erdogan, and that's why Turkey probably won't give up easily.
Well, I'm glad you pointed all of that out, because Turkey did get somewhat involved. Their jets entered the airspace. They obviously didn't launch any airstrikes on anything, but they did jam. So they started jamming radar and Israeli jets, and they threatened to shoot down the planes. They shot warning shots. So Israel retaliated by threatening to shoot down Russian planes and then, or shoot down Turkish planes, and then Russian jets scrambled. So all of this is sort of like, it kind of, and obviously there was nothing too serious that occurred during all of this sort of scrambling. But I wanted to point it out just to show how many moving pieces are kind of happening and how they can all kind of happen very quickly. This was all within like a 6-hour period, all of this stuff happened. pretty crazy. What are your thoughts about that? Israel has come out again and said, we will shoot down your jet if you even like come near us. And Russia having to scramble their jets because they were bombing places in Latakia and Tartus. So what are your thoughts about that? And where does it leave Russia?
You mean in terms of Syria? I mean, I think Russia's cutting its losses in Syria. As for Israel, what I was going to say for Israel is all these actions make me feel like there's a coming security dilemma for Israel, because it makes the future riskier and riskier for them, because as they, you know, have more and more issues with their neighbors, this makes the long-term survival of Israel kind of shaky. And so I think that, you know, for long-term security of the region, we just find new rivals that show up for Israel. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're right. I just wanted to, and then after that threat, Israel invades on the ground. They did a deep, deep ground incursion, and I believe that they're still there. Israeli helicopters landed to give supplies to the Druze fighters in the area, and they continued ongoing airstrikes. That was yesterday. I'm not sure of what's going on today. They are now considering setting up a field hospital for Druze separatists, which means that they're thinking that fighting is going to continue and they want to be able to support that. They've given them weapons. Now they're talking about medical assistance. They actually airlifted Druze fighters out of there yesterday with the helicopters after they dropped off those supplies. Arab tribes, Bedouins actually, in southern Syria started blocking the roads to protest the Druze. This is how messy, like, Syria, it's just very bad. The UN, multiple members of the EU and a few others in the international community have called for Israel to de-escalate. Turkish and Israeli relations are now in a free fall. The ambassador has been recalled back to Ankara. The diplomatic mission is understaffed and collapsing. And then Israel issued a formal warning to the U.S. that it will target Turkish jets in Syrian airspace if the conflict escalates further, to which Turkey responded by closing all of its airspace to all Israeli flights, including Netanyahu's planned vacation to Baku. So no more Azerbaijan flight for Bibi. Maybe. We don't know yet. Maybe he'll go. Then he canceled the trip. So no Azerbaijan, friends. Or Bibi, how do you feel about this?
Azerbaijan will kind of be on the sidelines, but the chat pointed out something correctly. Just to quickly add, you know, the way the chessboard kind of can lay out in the Middle East is that, you know, there's this Turkey and Qatar axis, and you know, who knows, maybe Saudi may be aligned with that, but you know, possibly a Israel and Saudi axis that counteracts that. And so you know, we have these shifting power players, but I've forgotten to mention the Qatar aspect to that. But sorry, you just asked me about.
I was just kind of teasing you and saying, how would you feel? How do you feel about Azerbaijan not getting to meet?
Yeah, so I'm over here like rambling and like talking about
myself. Azerbaijan's busy. They're blowing up stuff in Iran. They don't need to meet with Bibi.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't pay that much mind to that, to like the importance of that even coming meeting.
Why do you think he would even go at this time? Like to go to Azerbaijan, was there any more intricate or hidden meetings behind that? I mean, we know what the relationship between Israel is. We don't need to go through all that.
I think Israel's checking Azerbaijan's temperature, because Azerbaijan's ties with Russia are growing, and you know, some people may say that, you know, ties with Russia means ties with Israel. There are those voices now, but I don't think that's the case quite yet. But yeah, I think Israel wants to see how that relationship, you know, would go, and always keeps its options open. You know, they're a true realist. But for right now, Azerbaijan will kind of matter less
than it already does. Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, other than the, you know, I know that there's the tensions with Iran, but I'm not convinced that Azerbaijan's going to be the launch pad for that.
Well, Azerbaijan's a better fit for Russia than Armenia. I mean, Azerbaijan's also sort of a mafia state, got a lot of like tough guys at the top. That Russia is much more like Azerbaijan than it is like Armenia. I feel like this is a much better fit for Azerbaijan.
Well, and that's what the, you know, the big debate always comes to is that, like, you know, Armenia is a democracy, and so that, like, that is a better fit for the EU. But then, you know, we don't like hearing that as well, because then that's just kind of like, it's like this empty talking point, right? It's like that, like Freedom House score type of talking point. Because, you know, having a tyrant or, you know, dictator is also something that the US likes and likes to work with. So it's one of those states that's like kind of very amenable to Russia and amenable to the West, because it's just very easy to control a government when it's all ruled by one family or one person. So everyone kind of wants a piece of that. And, you know, so they have options. They have people that come to them to lobby.
And I know our listeners would be mad, but Marat would be glad if I didn't talk about Ansarallah hitting Ben Gurion Airport today. They hit the airport. I don't know what this means. I don't know what this changes, but they hit the airport. I mean, I love Ansarallah. I love Yemen. But yeah.
Nothing ever happens. Something always happens, but then nothing ever happens. So it's
yeah,
just like,
I mean, like, what do we get? What do we, I mean, it scared some Israelis, I guess. Brianna Wu is very scared. So, I mean, that's a victory in and of itself. She's on Twitter freaking out, or she's on Twitter freaking out about possibly almost being bombed in Israel. But yeah, I don't. And then, oh, Iran unveiled a new weapon today, which. Yeah. No, it's. No. I wrote a post about it, but I don't. It's a new missile that they said that they actually did, and I do believe this, but they did use the lessons learned from the True Promise 2 or the strikes on Israel to build missiles that were more advanced, which obviously that's what you do. But whether the way we'll get to see them in action, I hope, but maybe not. Romanian election is also today. So
keep an eye on that.
Yeah, keep an eye on that. I think our guy is winning. Oh, yeah, he is. George Simion leads the Romanian presidential race with over 40%. Thank God. And the Yemeni armed forces issued a short statement emphasizing that from this hour, they will declare a no-fly zone in all the skies. Wait, okay. Okay. Thank you, producer. They will declare a no-fly zone in all the skies of the occupied territories, including and especially the Ben Gurion Airport. The Yemeni armed forces called on all civilian airlines to take this warning seriously and refrain from flying to the occupied territories. This action is completely operational, given that the Yemeni army has reached a new level of technology to bypass the defense systems of the Zionist regime and the United States. Let me add to that, Israel is blaming the United States for this missile getting through because the THAAD did not pick it up and shoot it down. This feels like a setup.
Yeah. Interesting. I didn't have notes on that one because
neither did I. He just sent it to us. I'm just reading it out loud to you, but it's like,
things come and you don't know if this is going to be one of those nothing happens things, but yeah, I hope not. Or I hope so, I should say.
Well, there's the thing is that I you never know, because I don't put it past Yemen to put out this statement or to follow through. Whether their capabilities match that, I don't know. But I also don't put it past Israel to fake all of this and to just shoot down their own plane. Like, I don't know. Like, that's the kind of like, that's the sort of irrational actor that I'm dealing with. And that's kind of why I asked. Now, I understand Yemen's actions and Yemen's positions and posturing. I get it all. Like, I totally support the Yemenis and they know that. But I don't put it past Israel to take advantage of this situation.
The thing that I'm a little bit confusing to follow in this conflict is that this is like a second front in terms of the axes, is that the Houthis are not aligned with the axis that we were just talking about, this, you know, Turkey and Qatar one. It's the opposite side. And so Israel just has a lot of, this is what I meant to get at earlier, is that Israel opens itself up to so many different fronts and so many different enemies that it's long-term, you know, the prospects of its lasting long-term feel low. And so, I mean, this, I don't know how you get out of this, you know, in long-term.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't see this situation is untenable. For Israel, it's unsustainable. I don't know how you pragmatically plan for, I mean, we talk about countries, Iran, Russia, and China. These countries plan for 100 years. I don't know how Israel could even foresee the next 10.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that the note you want to end on?
It's that fun and cheery note.
Well, maybe we'll make fun of Miss Sarah. We'll give you guys a happy, well, not a happy ending. We'll give you guys a happy note to go out on with one Miss Sarah clip. Miss Sarah was pranked this week by none other than whatever their names are, Bowman and Lexus, right? Is that their names that they prank all of the world leaders? But anyway, Massaro tells us what we've known all along. And you know what? It's actually good to see Massaro. It's been almost, I haven't seen Massaro in like a year. So it's good to see that he's still getting play. It's good to see that he's still out there. Next week, we'll be back on Sunday with another, hopefully not as exhaustive episode. I hope you guys took notes. If not, it'll be available on all of our platforms, including Spotify. Please visit the website. Give us a follow on Twitter. Please, I beg you, try to engage with our X account. It is so shadow banned and just screwed. And while I'm on my own personal Twitter hiatus, I'll be trying to get the big Twitter kind of more active. So thank you. And Marat, any closing thoughts before we end with a Massaroism, the Balkanization of Russia?
If she's going to be on Twitter hiatus, just follow me instead.
Follow Marat. Everybody follow Marat. I may pop up from time to time, but please follow Marat. Seriously. He's always writing these funny racist things about like genealogy and DNA, and they give you scientific basis to go be racist. It's great.
Racist, kind of ironically. I like to post on DNA. Give me a follow and give Sarah a follow because she'll be back eventually. We know.
Yeah, sure. All right. Balkanization of Russia. Guys, have a good rest of your Sunday. Thank you for watching. We'll be available on all platforms. Support us, please. We are broke. Thank you and have a good week.
That's the problem is, you know, you run into this issue with, I think, sort of Russian identity as it's currently constituted. And it doesn't need to be constituted like this forever. I mean, if you really wanted reform in that region, size and shape and, you know, lack of borders and all that kind of stuff has to change. You know, I mean, there's a lot of change that needs to happen. That's why we talked a lot at the commission about sort of decolonization for a while. The point remains that, you know, a sustainable region and a peaceful region, a prosperous region will require, you know, a Russia that's significantly changed, and not just internally, but also like borders changed, independence for various peoples most likely, or some kind of true federalism, I guess. But I thought that's really what we tried in 91 was to achieve a Russian federalism. And I think at this point we can successfully say Russian federalism failed. We want to focus on China. I mean, we've been in this like 15-year pivot to Asia where we never actually make it to Asia, you know, because Russia won't let us, you know. And the way to do it is to defeat Russia. But unfortunately, it's just really, it's really hard for people to imagine that for whatever reason. Well, it's our fight too, brother. I mean, that's what it's all about. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I believe in my country and I believe in the cause of my country. And also, I mean, your victory is our victory. It would be very, very, very good for the United States to have Russia defeated. And like I said, if Russia were defeated and humbled finally, that would also let us focus on other pressing national security issues. I've come to really understand that the threat that Russia poses to the United States and that Russia poses to the civilized world, really, I mean, it's not just sort of this
this, you know, sort of barbarian horde, right? This human wave attack thing. It's that Russians are really, 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 really good at this information warfare stuff.